You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. And a warm welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's show, there are jitters on the European markets following the downgrading of Spanish banks. Our man in Florence will be giving us a tour of the art and tourism fair, and we'll be opening some wine that's been made in Italy by some Frenchmen at the instigation of some Germans. Also coming up, mind the map, we celebrate arguably one of the most useful pieces of design London has ever offered.
The title takes its name from a Hindu word, or rather it's originally from Sanskrit, for seven sages, the seven rishi, who are sometimes regarded as sort of the patriarchs of Vedic religion.
And we meet the neighbours. Today it's the turn of a restaurant with strict traditions.
We're not allowed any milk or dairy within the restaurant, so it's little rules like that. As a meaty restaurant, we abide by it, and we've been very successful doing it for the past 30-something years.
All that plus some great music, that's coming up on Midori House here on Monocle 24. But before that, let's get the latest news from Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Forces loyal to the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have shot two protesters in the capital, Damascus, today and fired into the air to break up thousands of anti-government demonstrators in the commercial hub of Aleppo. It was another day of street protests in Aleppo, Syria's second largest city, where a visit by UN ceasefire monitors a day earlier saw demonstrators mass outside the gates of the Aleppo University before security forces drove them off. In Canada, angry students have vowed to fight a tough new law being proposed to quell 14 weeks of strikes and protests against tuition hikes in the province of Quebec. The government there is seeking to end demonstrations and wants to make anyone organising a protest of more than 10 people to give police 8 hours advance notice. The students, who pay some of the lowest tuition fees in North America, say the price hikes would leave them facing thousands of dollars in debt. Tul Shritu, a Thai national, has appeared at a magistrate court in Johannesburg today on charges connected to rhino poaching activities. He's believed to be part of a syndicate exporting rhino horns. During the court proceedings, a state prosecutor said bail of 100,000 rand, or $12,000, was acceptable to the prosecution.
The state is not opposing bail. I will state the reasons. The address of the accused is known. The amount of bail that's being tendered is acceptable to the state. 100,000 rand bail has been tendered. That's also the same amount that has been fixed for the other South African citizen that has been charged in this matter.
The finance minister of Latvia has said that the country's plan to join the euro in 2014 is now in the balance and depends on a swift solution to the economic crisis rocking Greece and other countries already in the currency zone. Andris Vilks said that there was a 90% chance Lithuania would meet the Maastricht criteria of currency stability, low debt and budget deficits. South Africa's ruling ANC has threatened to take legal action against a Johannesburg gallery for displaying art which lampoons President Jacob Zuma and accuses the party of corruption. The African National Congress wants the Goodman Gallery to remove a painting of Zuma called The Spear, which depicts the president with his genitals exposed, and another work that has a for sale sign superimposed over the party logo.
I think they're angry about defamation. I think it's related specifically to the president's image, to how he's portrayed in the public. They are also angry about the way that we've represented the ruling party, well, not we, the artist, and the work that the gallery is presenting.
And finally, a psychic pig is set to take over where Paul the Octopus left off at the 2010 World Cup by predicting the results of matches at this year's European Championships in Ukraine and Poland. Kiev city government said today it would wheel out the Porky Tipster to give daily forecasts once the tournament kicks off next month. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed for that. The time is just nudging 5 minutes to the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The Propajalavat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a very warm welcome back to Midori House. While the continuing upsets in Greece and Spain have resulted in a shaky end to a wobbly week on the markets, Spain's main index dropped 2% but has recovered this afternoon, despite the ratings agency Moody's cutting the credit ratings of some 16 Spanish banks on Thursday. And of course, who could forget the bigger hole that Greece seems to be digging for itself in the past few days? Well, to assess quite a remarkable week, I'm joined by Professor Ian Begg. He's Associate Fellow in the Europe programme at London-based think tank Chatham House. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Ian. Can you remember a week like it?
Oh yes, many. We've been through this sort of thing time and again over the last few months. So it's not as dramatic as it sounds.
It does sound quite dramatic, though, that we've had this almost perfect storm occurring of Greece deciding that it needs to go into another election, and Spain in the meantime starting to crumble around the edges. It's quite unusual because both could exacerbate each other's problems, couldn't they?
Well, yes. I think what we're seeing is an approach to the end game in the euro crisis, insofar as it's now forcing the Germans and the French to come together to find a solution. And it may well be that, contrary to all the propaganda, the fact that there's now somebody with a more growth-orientated approach in François Hollande as the new president of France will push the Germans to change.
I mean, do you think it could be as simple as Hollande forcing everybody to reassess the situation? Because the big question is Europe going to renegotiate the austerity plan with Greece, or is this going to be the time when Greece leaves?
Well, I think it's a misunderstanding to say that because Greece is in difficulty, it necessarily has to leave the euro. It can default or adopt a different policy, but still retain the same currency. So it's a misguided analysis to say it's inevitably going to leave the euro. In exactly the same way, California has a huge public sector difficulties, but nobody talks about California leaving the dollar.
The markets have been uncertain today. Where are investors moving their money to at the moment?
I think they're probably sitting on their money and hoping that something will change to enable them to make more rational decisions. There isn't that easy an option for anybody to pick at the moment, unless you invest in wine, of course.
Let's look at Spain now, because Spain has been dominating the headlines for the past 24 hours. There have been mass withdrawals from the Spanish bank Bankia, but the government is maintaining that it does not expect this to be a run on Spanish banks. Firstly, when does a mass withdrawal become a run? And secondly, how dangerous is this situation for people to withdraw? I think it's up to €1 billion from their accounts.
Well, Bankia is a big bank, but the Spanish authorities have taken the right steps to try to sort it out by injecting capital, in effect, doing much the same as was done in an earlier phase of this crisis when banks like the Royal Bank of Scotland or HBOS in the UK or many of the big American banks were given support by the state. It's a process that is becoming understood. The trouble is the Spanish should have done it much sooner, and if they'd done that, I think the scale of the problem would be much less. Now, a run in the bank can multiply if the depositors in the bank don't have confidence in the authorities. But my judgment is that the way the Spanish authorities have been dealing with this is appropriate for the scale of the problem they face.
Commentators are saying, though, that there's a perfect storm for Spanish banks in the form of contagion coming from Greece and then hitting the Spanish government bonds, and that will then hit the Spanish banks. How do the Spanish actually get themselves out of this mess?
Well, I think that is a wrong analysis as well, because the problems in Spain arise principally because they had an overextended property market, an asset bubble in the property market, which has always been there since 2008. Spain has not been directly affected by Greece because Spanish banks, so far as I know, have had very little involvement in Greece. So it's more a sentiment than anything else. What is now becoming clear is the magnitude of the losses that some of the Spanish banks like Bankia have made on their property portfolios. But other Spanish banks are not really that exposed to it. So it's an unknown, but it's an unknown of magnitudes that are not going to be so devastating as they were in Greece.
When we look at the Spanish banks, let's look ahead to Monday, because firms in charge of auditing Spain's banks will be announced. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's likely to happen there?
Well, I think they'll be going through a process of what's called stress testing, trying to work out how much capital the Spanish banks have and does it enable them to withstand losses on their property portfolios that might be even bigger than they've presently announced. So let's say a house halves in value, the mortgage holder is unable to repay it because that mortgage holder is then in negative equity. At that point, the bank's in trouble rather than the mortgage holder. That's the test that the auditors were trying to impose.
Also, we're looking at the rest of the markets. There's Asia. Banking shares there have been hurt because I think the chief executive of ANZ has said volatile market conditions means that the Australian banks are not lending to each other. Can you see a worst case scenario? This is a snowball effect. But what effect are this week's events having on the rest of the global markets?
Well, uncertainty is in nobody's interest, and it's when you get this kind of uncertainty that you find banks becoming reluctant to lend to each other, and the whole interbank market tends to freeze up. That's what happened after Lehman Brothers in 2008. It happened before Christmas when there was great uncertainty about Greece. The authorities do have a remedy for this, which is precisely what Ben Bernanke did in the US and what Mario Draghi did in the euro area, which is to pump money into the system. And when they do that, it seems to work.
And is this the thing that will calm investors?
Yes, and we've seen a number of episodes where that's happened.
Let's look ahead to this week's weekend's G8 summit at Camp David. When you think about what's happening this weekend, there are echoes of the firefighting of the G20 in Cannes last year. Last time they were bailing Greece out. Now there is a potential of everything is on the table now, isn't it? Because Hollande's here, Greece needs to be sorted out, Spain needs to be sorted out. What do you think is going to be on the agenda and what may be achieved?
Well, there'll be a lot of banging of heads going on. I'm sure that people like Obama and Cameron will gang up at Angela Merkel and say, come on, Angela, sort out your reluctance to deal with Greece, to make enough money available for it. There'll be attempts to put together collective communications, which will try to reassure markets. I think that between Hollande and Merkel, you begin to see the outlines of a growth package to complement the famous fiscal compact that has been agreed previously, something to give a glimmer of hope to countries like Greece, which don't see a way out of their mess.
You mentioned at the beginning of this interview François Hollande coming in and shaking things up a little bit. Tell us more about that.
Well, he campaigned on the idea that fiscal austerity on its own wouldn't work. Now, fiscal austerity is a bit of a misnomer in any case, because the thing that the Greeks have been asked to do above all is to restructure their economy, to tear up some of the restrictions on trade, the labour market rigidities that have caused the trouble in the first place. But Hollande is saying, let's do this in a context in which we can promote growth. He wants to do that by things like immediate infrastructure projects, developing arcane instruments like project bonds to support that, finding ways of injecting a bit of demand into the system to make it easier for countries that have to go through these awkward transitions.
Let's briefly go back to the Greek situation. There are reports that the EU commissioners are still cannot decide what they're telling everybody about the situation with regards to Greece. It's understood that one trade commissioner has said that emergency contingency planning has already begun for a Greek exit, whereas the EU Commission vice president has said that they're not preparing for any exit at all. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's loose talk, and loose talk causes trouble. But I would still insist that the issue for Greece is much more default than euro exit. They're not the same thing, and there's been an analysis which says they are the same thing, which I simply don't believe in.
And finally, we mentioned in the news a few moments ago that Lithuania is thinking about wishing to join the single currency in the next few years. Are they making a wise move in so doing?
Well, to understand what they're up to, you have to recognise that Lithuania has a fixed exchange rate against the Deutschmark or the euro for more than 15 years. they see that as part of their source of stability. So it would only really be converting the notes and coins they use rather than the approach they have to policy making. So it's not as dramatic as it would be for a country which would have to peg its exchange rate.
Ian, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Ian Begg, Associate Fellow in the Europe Programme at Chatham House. The time is just coming up to 15 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be right back with some music.
The June issue of Monocle is a round-the-world ticket that takes in the best boats and planes and trains in our annual transport survey. We also reach for the skies as we climb to the top of Tokyo's new Skytree Tower, stay ahead as we meet an Ethiopian Olympic icon, and visit Kolkata as the city tries to step up a gear. And there's lots more.
In the culture section, Aisha Spears looks beyond the Steers and Stetsons to profile the gallerists and collectors at this year's Dallas Art Fair. Design Miami founder Craig Robbins talks us through his art, and there's a wonderful column on the art of wandering.
In the design section, we head north to Stockholm for a global exclusive of Ett Hem, a small hotel with big ambitions to shake up the hospitality industry.
There's also our 36-page Thailand National Survey that puts a spotlight on the country's top tech firms, horticultural hothouses, and some cool brewers too. The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centred businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
The latest episode of The Entrepreneurs kicks off by looking at Berlin's burgeoning tech scene through the lens of Gidsy, a startup specialising in trading experiences. We were then joined in the studio by former furniture designer William Kroll, founder of British fashion and craft brand Tender, as well as checking in on a Parisian shoemaker who gave up consultancy to follow his dream business.
I decided to create a shoe brand because I wanted to mix, on the one hand, business and on the other hand, creativity and arts.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be enjoying a little Florentine culture, but first, let's have some music. This is Arcade Fire. And that was Arcade Fire with Sprawl 2. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us because in the next few moments we'll be tasting a remarkable new French and German wine that's been made in Italy. But we'll stay in Italy for the moment. You'd think a similar event would already be in existence, but the Art and Tourism Exhibition is the first international fair dedicated to culture and art tourism. It's been held rather appropriately in Florence, from where we can join Monocle's Ivan Carvalho. Ivan, very warm welcome to Midori House as usual. It's something you'd imagine existed already, but it appears not.
Yeah, good evening, Emma. You'd think that this would be in its 20th edition by now, like a Art Basel fair. But it's the first time, and out of the gates, from what I saw today on the first day, there's fully Italian tourism brands, lots of small cities, regional governments putting together stands to lure tour operators and travel agencies to come see the many great cultural offerings that Italy has.
It's just Italy then. I mean, cultural tourism just seems to be synonymous with Italy. Does it need to grow anymore?
Well, there were some other stands. There were the Swiss and there were the Estonians, for example. But it was geared towards Italy, and of course, Italy is number one when it comes to, for example, it has the most UNESCO cultural sites in the world. They're up towards almost 50, and it's a country that there's so many. I mean, museums that if you just spend time looking at all the national state museums that were in the list of the ministry, you could spend the next 20 years trying to go around and see all the artwork and paintings and sculpture.
So, it, I mean, obviously they've got plenty to offer, but how are they selling themselves? And, you know, obviously they're not selling themselves in a way that, well, that they obviously need a fair to try and sort their act out.
Yeah, they. I was talking to an official at the Ministry of Tourism. They were saying it's a market that's growing, and they want to tap into it because, you know, people come to Italy for vacation, maybe go to the beach or the mountains to have great food and do shopping, and they maybe work in a gallery show, perhaps. But they want to try to develop that more because the majority of people that go to the museums, they, for example, there's 3 billion visitors a year to just the state museums in Italy, and the majority of those are foreign. They see growth there in terms of the visitor numbers in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's a market they want to try to expand on because whereas other, for example, the beach attendance at beaches, whether it's the Italians going to the beach, those figures have remained fairly stable over the last, say, 10 years. And so they're trying to gather their forces together to offer different kinds of tours than sort of the traditional, you know, museum visits to get people to, you know, take another look.
So they're taking another look not only at things like the ancient monuments of Italy, and then we have the amazing, you know, Renaissance art of, let's say, Florence. What role does more modern offerings have to play?
Yeah, I was very intrigued by the contemporary art that I saw, the tours that were organized on visiting contemporary artwork in Italy. For example, you know, Tuscany has had a lot to offer in terms of Renaissance works, but there were tours going around where, for example, there are these parks throughout Tuscany that have contemporary art, so you can see sculptures in the landscape. There's even wineries, and I've actually visited one, Castello d'Amma. They have installations their winery where they invite artists every year to come and create a work, and so weaving that into the offering of having a nice glass of maybe rosé made from San Francisco and then going seeing an Anish Kapoor work in an altar, and something that other people were talking about in Rome, because it's not just going to see the Colosseum and the ancient ruins, but to try to get more interest maybe into the contemporary art gallery scene as well.
So who's actually exhibiting there? Are we talking about people like the likes of the Uffizi? Are we also talking smaller exhibitors as well?
There were a lot of smaller exhibitors. For example, there were a collection of towns that got together, organized around the fact that Leonardo da Vinci was born in the town of Vinci. And so these towns decided to put on an offering where for 3 days someone could come and visit and see his birthplace. And then also there would be a tour, maybe sort of some wine tasting and some food. And then also I noticed in this, in the video that they were showing me, there were some contemporary sculptures in piazzas that had been placed. Maybe the inspiration of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. There was a great and very interesting sculpture publicly displayed in a piazza. So there are these ways of alluring people for the old masters and then also the new works. And so it's sort of this mixing. And a lot of smaller cities, for example, Matera down in Basilicata, which is not a place where a lot of people go to. It's in the sort of the instep of the Italy. But they have a UNESCO site, these old grottos, these old cave dwellings that are very, very old. And one gentleman, an Italian-Swedish entrepreneur, has put together this hotel offering. So you can go and stay in these traditional caves. They've obviously put in some new bath furnishing fittings and nice beds. And you can go around and experience this very ancient city.
Are there any sort of rather nasty, gimmicky things like you know, having paintings in your bedroom that you can borrow and things like that?
Well, actually, in terms of borrowing paintings, there was an interesting thing through the state broadcaster, Rai, where they've been doing reproductions of very famous works, say Caravaggio, Da Vinci, and what they do is they offer these. They're the same size as the actual pieces. So, for example, they had a client, a woman from Holland, who was visiting the fair, and she wants to put on a Da Vinci celebration. Maybe they have some. They have some manuscripts and some writings, but they want to weave in and make the exhibit more colorful, and so they can actually for, I think you said it costs about 65,000 euros, Da Vinci painting for 4 months. So if they get enough people coming in with the receipts from the ticket sales, they can, you know, pay off that, and they can have a nice, you know, reproduction. Because think about it, the big museums can ask maybe once in a while from their partner museums for a couple of Caravaggios, but these sort of maybe smaller regional cities, they're down in the pecking order. So to have to wait for, you know, an exhibit to put on a Caravaggio might take, you know, centuries for them. So this gives them a way to circumvent that and maybe have a show they can put on, inexpensively, but still give people, you know, an access to art.
And finally, Ivan, I mean, it's a bit of a puzzler. Anyone who's been to Rome will sharpen their elbows to get through the narrow streets of Florence. Says that there's probably a lot of tourists there already. What new markets are they having to look to?
In terms of, you know, the traditional travelers from, you know, the UK, France, Germany, the US, they're that make up still today the so-called città d'arte visitors. And so they're trying to look at their eyes. I noticed there was some Brazilian, Hungarian, a few Chinese, obviously, tour operators, agencies that were looking around to sort of put together tours for people back home. These will be the countries in the future. Again, it's still something that needs to be developed, because this is when you talk about some of these cultural tours, you're looking at people with more means, and so it's going to be something that they're working on developing. I mean, it's amazing looking at the data from the ministry. The traditional powers are still there: the French, the English, you know, the grand tours. They're always coming every year in and year out. Maybe some of the emerging markets are still more keen on, say, shopping, because Italy, of course, is also very attractive for shopping. So, you know, they have opportunities there, and I think that's why this fair was put together, to sort of tap into some of these markets.
Ivan, thank you very much indeed, as ever, for joining us. That was Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's man in Milan, who's in Florence. The time is 29 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll be opening a bottle of fine wine with our acting edits section editor. I suspect that wine has already been opened, and we'll meet the neighbours. But first, here's Jonathan with the news headlines in just a moment.
London Ball, as a Monocle who's on need.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
De Londres, este es Monaco 24.
London Cala, Monaco 24 des.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
Londonist, sino Monaco 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monaco 24.
Λόντζαδαν, Μπουρσε, Monaco 24.
London Cala, Monaco 24.
Monocle 24 News with Jonathan Wheatley. Forces loyal to the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have shot two protesters in the capital, Damascus, today and fired in the air to break up thousands of anti-government demonstrators in the commercial hub of Aleppo. In Canada, angry students have vowed to fight a tough new law being proposed to quell 14 weeks of strikes and protests against tuition hikes in the province of Quebec. The students, who pay some of the lowest tuition fees in North America, say the price hikes would leave them facing thousands of dollars in debt. A Thai national has appeared at a magistrate court in Johannesburg today on charges connected to rhino poaching activities. He's believed to be part of a syndicate exporting rhino horns. The finance minister of Latvia has said that the country's plan to join the euro in 2014 is now in the balance and depends on a swift solution to the economic crisis rocking Greece and other countries already in the currency zone. And South Africa's ruling African National Congress has threatened to take legal action against a Johannesburg gallery for displaying art which lampoons the president, Jacob Zuma, and accuses the party of corruption. And for the moment, those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back with us at the top of the hour for a full roundup of today's world headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. It's 27 minutes before the top of the hour, and it's time now for our daily chat with the Monocle editor on Midori House to find out what they've been up to. Today, I'm delighted to say Santiago Tarditi, our acting edits editor, has staggered down, floated down the stairs from the from the editorial floor to have brought us a bottle of wine. Thank you very much indeed, Santiago. He's also brought a rather wonderful lady with him. We'll talk to you in a moment, madam. But, Santiago, why have you brought the wine and why have you brought the girl?
Well, the girl I come today with is Olimpia Romba. She is the spokesperson for Monteverro, a new wine estate in Tuscany, very young, producing very good wines. It's a wine that has received great reviews by Robert Parker and by Decanter Magazine and other publications that cover the wine trends and the wine market. This is a wine that is produced in southern Italy. Michel Roland, the very famous wine consultor, helped develop these flavors. And I know you're a fan of Italian wine, but this is Italian wine.
The geographical origin is not necessarily the most important part. But well, yes, I do like Italian wine.
It's very interesting that you say that, because this wine is actually made out of French grapes, but it's grown in Italian soil.
Well, Olimpia, let's talk to you about a little more about this. Hello, a very warm welcome to Midori House. So your wine is Tuscan, but it's got a German owner and made by a Frenchman. Explain how that happened.
It's a very international project, yes, indeed. The owner is Georg Weber, behind the project, and he discovered this land, which is a 25-hectare land in the very southern part of Tuscany. So we are 1 hour north of Rome and 1 hour south of Siena. And our enologist is Mathieu Tonnet, a young gentleman. Our consultant is Michel Roland. And we are working only with French grape varieties.
Now, you're only using French grape varieties.
Exactly.
You've got Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, things that you'll only see in France. What was wrong with the Italian grapes?
Nothing wrong with the Italian grapes. We just discovered that on this soil, to produce high-end quality wines with a potential, with an aging potential, the best is to use these grape varieties.
So basically, you have an aging potential here. So we're looking at the very high-end market of fine wines,
yes.
Very complex wine,
yes.
Stuff that you might arguably say would rival Bordeaux and Burgundy, but without actually having to take them on their own territory, you go somewhere else and you sort of make your mark slightly differently. Is that right?
That is right. We are really positioning ourselves among the super Tuscan wines. So this means the wines produced in Tuscany, but with Bordeaux grape varieties.
And it doesn't taste anything like a Bordeaux, though, does it?
Well,
It does have certain similarities. I'm only saying this because we had lunch together today, and I got to try these wines before I actually brought them here. I was doing a bit of a quality control, of course.
Thank you, Santiago. I was worried.
Taking one for the team. But yeah, of course, it does have certain similarities, but it has its own identity. Okay. I think the best way to see this is by pouring yourself a glass.
I think we're going to have to try
a
little bit. I'm a little bit far away from it. Olimpia, would you be kind enough to
possibly
about a quarter of that amount, but I'll let that breathe for just a moment and then I'll have a go. So Olimpia, you've got French grapes. What are the methods by which you're actually making the wine? Are you using a French technique or an Italian technique? And what materials are you using?
Okay, so our technique is our wines are really handcrafted. So harvest, of course, by hand, triple sorting table, 100% gravity in our cantina, no pumping at all, natural fermentation, no filtration. These are just some keywords. Of our wines and during the production process.
And who is
so
your market?
So the know-how. Sorry. So the know-how is really coming from the big wines, from the Grand Cru Classé of Bordeaux, and that's it. So okay. The result is a small production. So I must say that we are producing 4 wines on 25 hectares, and
that's a lot of wine for not very much space, isn't it? 4 different wines.
4 different wines, yeah. But we are talking about small productions. So, for example, the Chardonnay, it's 100% Chardonnay, and we only have 1 hectare, and we're producing more or less each year 3,000 bottles of this wine.
And you're using, what, French barrels? Or
we are only using French barrels, yeah, coming from, Bordeaux Coopers.
So effectively, you have transplanted foreign methods into Italy. I asked you now what was wrong with the Italian grapes. I'll ask you now. What has been the Italian reaction to your invasion of their terroir?
The Italian reaction was very, very well. I must say that we are 1 hour south of the famous zone Bulgari, where you can, you know, find the big names like Onelaya, Sasikaya, and the Italian reaction on us was very positive, as we were the pioneers in this area. We are the first ones having planted Chardonnay, Syrah Grenache, and the other grape varieties, and we are very happy there, and they welcomed us very positively there.
The Tuscan region even gave you the Indicazione Geografica Tipica,
exactly.
Right?
So you have a dominazione.
Our
wines are
of EGT
origin. Toscana, sì.
Oh, right.
So they're officially recognized by the region as locally produced and keeping up with the standards of the rest of the wine growers in the same area.
So you obviously have this very high level. You're trying to get a premier Grand Cru of Tuscany. Who are you aiming this at? Who is your market?
Well, for the moment, our market is international, so we are very well-placed and distributed in whole Europe. We are very happy to say that we are here in the UK. I'm here for the Decanter Italian Fine Wine Encounter, which takes place tomorrow at the Landmark Hotel, if I may say. Our wines are, for example, at Harvey Nichols and so on. So we are very happy. So the UK is one of our biggest markets. Then the other European markets like Germany, Switzerland, Austria, and UK, Canada. And the big focus this year is Asia.
And are people buying the wine to keep and put aside for a long time, or is this immediate consumption?
Okay, it depends. So as I said, we are producing 4 wines, 1 Chardonnay and 3 red wines, which I tasted with Santiago today. There is the Terra di Montevero, which is a very pleasant wine. The French people would say un vin de plaisir, ready to drink, accessible immediately. And there is, of course, the Grand Cru, which is called Montevero, and this has an aging potential. So this I would put away.
That's the one you have.
Some years.
That's the one you have. You should try it.
You have poured me a glass of which one?
Of the Grand Cru.
The Grand Cru, of course. What is in this? What grapes?
So here you have Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and Petit Verdot.
Okay, so I'm expecting a really good Bordeaux in my glass. Okay, what should I be looking for? I'm going to make a very unpleasant sound, I'm afraid. You two do carry on amongst yourselves. I'm just going to have a glass of wine.
How would you describe the aromas in this wine and the flavors? Because I remember during our lunch today, we were talking about very, very bold flavors, but still it's a very light wine and very easy to drink.
We decanted it, to be very honest. So the wine had time to open up. You will find blackberries in this wine. You will find soft tannins and we'll find some vanilla notes, of course.
Oak notes. A bit of leather.
Exactly.
It is absolutely amazing. It's incredibly complex. Starts off very, very tannic and then softens.
And it softens even more in some years, you know what I mean? It's very young.
And it has a sharpness at the end of it that sort of strikes you on the side of your mouth. Not like an Italian, not like a French wine at all. It has a slight amount of exposure to hot weather.
I agree.
That you only ever get in Italy.
Yeah, I agree.
That's astonishing. It starts like a Bordeaux and ends like a wild night in Florence. It's brilliant.
and we are very happy. I'm very happy that you're saying this, but because
I'm wrong,
as you say,
I've got it wrong.
These are Bordeaux grape varieties, but nevertheless, the terroir is in Italy, so we are very proud to produce wines
wine,
in Italy.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's an Italian wine at the end of the day.
It is a splendidly confused wine. Thank you very much indeed, Olympia. I shall enjoy the rest of that glass. It's an absolute pleasure. And Santiago, I understand this is going to be in the next edition of Monocle, is that right?
Yeah, we're planning on visiting the wine estate and doing an interview with the sommeliers there and the people behind the project.
Olympia Rombo, grazie mille.
Grazie.
18 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Londoners take it for granted. Tourists gaze at it. Artists and designers play with it. The London Tube Map is arguably a shining combination of form, function and indeed beauty. Well, a new exhibition celebrates the Tube Map and associated designs for the London Underground. Mind the Map, it's called, and it explores our relationship between identity and place and shows just how much the Tube Map has inspired people over the years. The exhibition's curator Claire Dobbins tells us more.
Mind the Map, Inspiring Art, Design and Cartography celebrates a century of creative and influential map design for London's underground. The exhibition looks at the development of the now iconic London tube map, and the distinctive diagrammatic form that it takes was introduced by Harry Beck in 1931. So we have some of his original drawings for that map, as well as the first 1933 published pocket map, which was the first diagrammatic tube map, which has inspired many other cities to take on the diagrammatic approach to mapping their metro systems. It's predominantly underground maps that we've focused on, but it's not just maps that were navigational, such as pocket maps for helping us get to A to B. There's also a whole section on decorative maps and how they've been used in publicity to promote services as well as help us navigate the city. The first tube map, pocket tube map, to show all of London's underground railways as one complete system was designed in 1908. And at that time, lines were operated by different companies, and it reflects a kind of more coordinated approach to their publicity. And over the years, as the underground system grew and grew more complex, designers found it more and more difficult to map in a geographical way, to map the lines in a way that was easy to read for the passenger. Harry Beck actually worked for the Underground as a draftsman in the mid to late 20s, and it was during a period of redundancy that he actually spent some time working out what a solution might be to the problem of mapping London's Underground. And he came up with the idea of using a diagram rather than a map. So although it's not as geographically accurate as former maps, it's much clearer and easier to use. But a number of artists and designers have been inspired by Harry Beck's diagrammatic tube map. And we have a display of posters, underground posters, which were promoting leisure travel, essentially. But they've taken the form of the map, which was popular with the public and distinctive and recognisable, and worked with it in different ways. We've also a selection of works from the early 90s through to the current day, where artists have taken the tube map as a source of inspiration for their work, such as Simon Patterson's Great Bear from 1992, which takes the tube map, an exact replica of the 1992 tube map, but he's changed the names of stations to the names of famous cultural figures. So each line represents a different line of celebrity, if you like, and creates a new kind of map of the stars. And we're delighted that Simon Patterson has also produced a new work for us called Saptarishi, which is also based on the tube map, the current 2012 tube map, and that's on display for the first time downstairs, so it's very exciting for us. His new work, 20 years on from the Great Bear, refers back to the Great Bear constellation, because Saptarishi actually means, it's another word for the plough or the Big Dipper, which is a section of the Great Bear constellation, and he's added some different categories of lines, categories of celebrity within his new work.
Exhibiting artists, Simon Patterson is probably best known here for his work when he was actually a
adult. I'm Simon Patterson, I'm an artist. I made a work 20 years ago called The Great Bear, which was it's a work I'm probably best known by, which is a reworking of the London Underground map. Saptarishi is a revisiting of the earlier work, but this time it's a work on enamel, an enamel sign, about approximately the same size as The Great Bear. The title takes its name from a Hindu word, or rather it's originally from the Sanskrit, for seven sages, or the seven rishi, who are sometimes regarded as sort of the patriarchs of Vedic religion. Say in India would be the name that was given to the, say, what we would call the Big Dipper. The stars in that particular asterism, a small group of stars, are named after the seven sages. In a way, I felt I was very pleased to be asked to make a new work, but I had a lot of worry about revisiting the work. I sort of completely dismantled throughout the idea of trying to just kind of play with the original idea and just completely remade it. But I made a decision to keep some things the same as I went along, as I remade each section of the work. So, for example, Docklands Light Railway is sinologues, people interested in Chinese culture or Chinese history, has remained the same title on this new work. And on the original, on the Great Bear, if you like, my original, not the original, on the area of the Docklands Light Railway that was under construction, there were names of dissidents from Tiananmen Square. Now, on Saptarishi, the Docklands Light Railway is entirely made up of Chinese dissidents. And what's odd and saddening is how many of those names recur. 20 years on are the same names of people that are still on a wanted list or in prison in China or can't return to China.
One of my favourite pieces is definitely Stephen Walter's new artwork, London Subterranea. It's a phenomenal artwork, and he's taken, there's a section in the exhibition on decorative maps used for publicity and the wonderful maps of McDonald Gill from the early 20th century. And he's kind of taken a modern twist on that kind of design and created this wonderful map of what lies beneath the city. So it's a map of London, not above ground but below ground, and it shows the geographical lie of the underground lines, but also other things you might find under the city, like lost rivers, burial sites, and it's just fantastic. It's very hard to describe, but you need to go and have a look at it for yourself because it's a phenomenal piece of work.
And that was Claire Dobbin, the curator of the Mind the Map exhibition at the London Transport Museum. And the exhibition, which begins today, Friday, runs until the end of October. You're listening to Midori House.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's 10 minutes before the top of the hour. In just a moment, we'll be heading round the corner to meet the neighbours. But taking us there, here's some music. This is Max Esser with We Can Run. And that was Max Esser with We Can Run There, 7 minutes towards the top of the hour. Well, it's Friday, which means it's time now to stroll around the corner and meet one of Monocle's lovely neighbours. Today we go to Ruben's on Baker Street, and this is what they had to say for themselves.
Good afternoon, Ruben's Restaurant. How can I help?
Hiya, I'm Ida and I work at Ruben's. I'm the manageress and it's on Baker Street, 79. It's been established in Baker Street for over 30 years now, and it's really kind of an icon for Baker Street, and it's moved from George Street further down and moved over to here about 10 years ago, and still keeping the same clientele, Jewish restaurant, and it's beautiful, it's amazing. Yeah, this is our current location in 79, but about 10 years ago we used to be in number 20A Baker Street, which is on the corner of George Street and Baker. So that again was a two-storey restaurant, and it's always been the split level of a snack bar and a main restaurant, but we also do takeaways, so we kind of cater for everything. Basically, around 30 years ago, there were three brothers named Reuben. And one of the brothers opened here, one opened in Toronto and one in America. So there's three, kind of a chain. They split off eventually, and the London-based one was sold to John Chesterman, who was then taken over a few years later by the current owners, who have had it for about 27 years now and have just continued running it and managing it and helped it to grow. And it's become a world known name now. The one in Toronto is still running, but they're no longer part of the Ruben's brand. So it used to be a connection, and it kind of just split off and different people then owned it and run it. And as far as I'm aware, the Toronto one's still going. As far as I'm aware, it was just a good location at the time. Obviously, I'm going back however many years ago when it was first established, but the actual original location was on a street corner where there was obviously a lot of flow of traffic. It's very close to Oxford Street, so you get the influx of tourists and people that are around that area. And the style of food that was presented was like very American deli, so it was kind of new as well when it was brought in. So everything about it was kind of different, but it needed to be central London, but also obviously Baker Street's always been a landmark, so it's a good location to have a restaurant in. Because of the fact that we're a kosher restaurant, we're licensed kosher, all our meat is something called glatt, so it's killed in a certain way to a certain level. It's overseen by a governing body called the Sephardi Kashrut Authority, which makes sure that we do everything in a certain way to keep with Jewish law. So the wines that we bring in have to be kosher. The meat is all bought from specialist butchers that are kosher with licensing. We're not allowed any milk or dairy within the restaurant. So it's little rules like that. As a meaty restaurant, we abide by it, and we've been very successful doing it for the past 30 something years. traditionally, we are a Jewish restaurant, so our main clientele is obviously people that are keeping kosher. But I think as the years have progressed, our non-kosher and Jewish clientele have expanded, because obviously an individual Jewish person might bring their friends who are not Jewish and not kosher just to experience what they've grown up with and what's kind of nostalgic food for them, and they just grow to love it. And obviously with American diners selling things like chicken soup with knedlers, people are more aware of the food that we do now. So I think our predominant audience is definitely a Jewish clientele, but it's branching out dramatically. We get a lot of people, fresh faces coming in all the time, saying that people are talking about our salt beef, people are now talking about our shawarma, which is another addition onto our menu, and we're becoming more and more famous outside of our circle of audience as well, which is lovely. You'll find reviews from America, from Australia, from South Africa. We get customers come from France just for the day to come and eat food by us, take salt beef away with them. There's people come from all around the world. So this is our famous salt beef at the front of the restaurant as you're walking past, and you can have it on rye bread, white bread, brown bread, and traditionally as we serve it as a Reuben, you'll have a layer of salt beef, some few tomatoes, pickled gherkins, another layer of bread, another layer of salt beef, sauerkraut or coleslaw, whatever you prefer, mustard on top, cut in half. It's like a tower of meat and veg, and it's just beautiful, and it'll melt in your mouth, and the kind of salt beef it is, it's wonderful. We've still got our Reuben sandwich, which is world famous. It's our double decker with salt beef and sauerkraut and pickles, and it's the whole nine yards. It's been talked about in various magazines, various newspapers talk about us being one of the best sandwiches in London that you can buy. And then obviously if you go downstairs to the main restaurant, you've got more of a refined style dining, so it's a sit down restaurant. You can have a real meal and things are cooked fresh to order, and everything's kind of in style and in keeping with the old traditions and the old food that we've done, but it's a little bit more modernised now. I've grown up on salt beef. Salt beef, sweet and sour pickle, little bit of mustard, rye bread, beautiful.
And delicious it is too. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. Our producer was Daniel Giacopelli, the researcher Ben Jay, our studio manager was Alex Jakes. Join me and Andrew Muller in 3 hours' time for today's Monocle Daily. We'll be talking about the emergence of airlines in the Balkans, and we'll be going out for a night out in Helsinki. From all of us, though, on Midori House, goodbye and thanks for listening.